Brigadier Scott, Reel 3. You were just giving me your appreciation of Wingate.
Yes. To me, undoubtedly, Brigadier Wingate was one of the greatest men I've ever met, or possibly ever likely to meet. Even those who disliked him had to admit that he was an outstanding leader. Completely unorthodox in his method, I think. But nevertheless, he was quite prepared himself, physically, to go into the spots which he'd ordered his men to do. The same place. He was not afraid. At least he never appeared to be afraid, even when we were in a tight corner. And this was great inspiration to all the rest of us. There were times when one thought you'd never see the Imphal again, wouldn't even see the Chinwin again, but his leadership and his drive and at heart his thought for those who served under him, I shall remember always. I think the image he gave to people, he wanted to be rough and hard. In his heart of hearts, he was quite human and quite soft.
Was there anything you didn't like about him?
No, there wasn't. No. I don't think I've ever met any leader who could have achieved to the same degree what Wingate did in that first campaign. He knew, I believe he knew, he was disliked. Not by those who served under him, but by a lot of the other people who possibly were conscious of his success in the end. And I do not know what heights he would have risen. But this I do know, during that second campaign, we were all inspired by what we'd seen in his being with him in the first campaign. He has a lot of his leaders he had in, the junior leaders he had in the first campaign, were willingly and keen to go back in again, as many did. I came back after the first campaign. Wingate was away in Delhi when I arrived at Imphal. When he came back, the first night I was with him, I said, "Look, sir, you know what went on with my chaps being rescued from the air by an airplane landing, by Dakota landing and flying them out." He said, "Yes, I know all about that." And I said, "Sir, if you could possibly drop me there with a good 30 or 40 men, well trained, we could raid the railway very often, up and down the whole stretch from Kothar to Michenar. We could play havoc with him during the rains." He said, "No, Scotty, your acorn, as you put it, is now an oak tree. And I know that someday you're going to see that oak tree." As it turned out to be, on the night I took off in the first glider, in the second campaign, Wingate was to remember what he'd said to me before. And he took me for a walk away from where everybody else was, all the other generals, and told me something which was for my ears alone and will always be for my ears alone. We came back and he said, "Right, let them roll." And he turned round, having said that, "You feel you've got to go." He turned round to General Slim and the other senior officers, and they agreed that we could go on, which is what we did. and I took off into my glider. I spoke of the oak tree, 1944, having been told by Wingate that night that I was going to see the oak tree and not the acorn. Our force had grown from one small brigade to a special force of six brigades with a bayonet strength of greater than two divisions. During the 9 months that we had been growing in strength, General Wingate had journeyed to London, Quebec and Washington. He had returned with the best backing that the imagination and skills of our allies could give him. Whilst in the USA, he had been fortunate enough to be placed under his command, No. 1 Air Commando, commanded by Colonel Cochrane. This force included fighters, bombers, gliders and transport planes. And last but not least, the light planes, almost 100 of them, for evacuation of our sick and wounded. For all but a few of the sick and wounded in the 43 campaign, there was one-way journey. These light planes were to change all that, and air evacuation was a certainty. I know personally that the care and fate of our sick and wounded was of great concern toward Charles Wingate, as I discussed it with him in detail on my return to Assam in 43. The new plan we had was that my 81 column was to be landed in a clearing that I knew from 1943, and that was to be codenamed Piccadilly. 82 column was to land by glider some 30 miles to the north in another clearing which was codenamed Broadway. The role of these columns was to clear the area of any enemy and to hold the ring whilst the construction unit prepared the ground wherever possible and to assist in preparations of new airstrips. In the late afternoon, Colonel Cochrane had sent a plane and a photograph recce flight to both landing strips. General Wingate, Brigadier Calvert and myself were standing at the head of a glider train when the pilot of the reconnaissance plane arrived back with a photograph of Piccadilly, which had been logged. The General, the Brigadier and myself joined Colonel Cochrane and Allison, his second in command, to study the photograph. There was a great silence. It showed that the clearing I knew so well from 1943 was now covered with large branches of trees. The plane that had flown over Broadway found there were no obstructions whatsoever. However, movement had been seen along the western edge. An intense silence broke on everybody in the vicinity. The full realization what had happened dawned on us. Wingate took the photograph from me and walked to where General Slim and the other Allied commanders were standing. After several minutes' conversation, General Wingate returned and handed it to me. He turned away with his head bent and his hands clasped behind his back. He looked a forlorn and lonely figure as he walked towards the setting sun. After going about 30 yards, he turned and called Brigadier Calvert, and after they had talked for a while, and then moved over to the Allied commanders, where a brief and vital conference took place. After General Wingate and Brigadier Calvert returned to me, and I received fresh orders that were so clear and so concise that it was hard for me to realise that Piccadilly ever existed. We were to instruct only one airfield, and that was to be at Broadway. someone had made a bold decision. Who it was, I do not know. Whether it was finally made by one man alone, I cannot say. But I do know this, that General Wingate's motto had long been, the boldest methods are the safest. After I'd given my column commanders, General Wingate, after I'd discussed it with them, after I'd given orders to my column commanders, General Wingate took me to the front of my glider and told me something which were my ears alone and forever will be my ears alone. He made the men in my glider, good luck, and finally turned again to me. He swept his hand towards the 60 or so gliders behind us and said, the oak tree. As we shook hands, I realised that General Wingate had complete control of himself. All his planning, his hopes, were now on the line, yet not the slightest tremor of his handshake or the flicking of an eyelid betrayed what really tensions were conflicting within. As my glider rose into the purple dusk now gathering above the mountains to the east, I was not thinking of what lay beyond them, but rather of General Wingate's unforgettable demonstration of cool, determined and inspired leadership. I believe that if ever I saw greatness in a human being, I saw it in General Wingate that night. Much has been written of old Charles Wingate, and no doubt much more will be written. And a lot will never be written. My column had travelled with Brigadier Wingate for most of the first campaign, 1943, until our attempted recrossing of Irrawaddy. And from then we went our separate ways. I knew he had I knew him enough to know that he had faults, but these were outweighed many, many times by his other sterling qualities. There are many events in my association with General Wingate I shall never forget, but I shall remember none better than his leadership on the 5th of March 1944. I believe it is easier to inspire men by leadership on the field of battle than to do so 100 miles behind your own lines. General Wingate had planned this operation over a period of many months, and here in the last hour it might have been postponed or even cancelled. Many a commander, under these circumstances, might have shown some sign of indecision. Many would have turned the men away from the vicinity so as not to see the intense personal feelings which intrude on such occasions. One would not blame a leader who took such strict action. One could only admire a leader who did not. In our history, men have seldom failed a leader, and I know none failed General Wingate that night. My many opinions of General Wingate have been expressed by those in authority, and I believe the one that history will record is that greater than all others, is that Winston Churchill in the House of Commons on August the 2nd, 1944, said, "There is a man of genius who might well have become a man of destiny." The achievements of General Wingate that history will record are many. For my part, I shall remember the powers of leadership, the faith he instilled in those who had the privilege to serve under him, his faith in the ability of the Royal Air Force and the USAAF to meet all requirements in regard to supplies, direct air support, and especially the rescue of our wounded. However, to me, the most important of General Wingate's achievements was not only to give those who served on him faith, confidence, and pride in themselves, but to raise the morale of the ordinary soldier facing the enemy on the Burma front, and also to raise the morale of servicemen throughout the Indian continent and to give us all hope. I believe that on the night of the 5th of March, the action and bearing of old Charles Wingate were those of a very great leader. History has not produced a perfect leader, and possibly it never will or never could. But old Charles Wingate lived But had old Charles Wingate lived, he may well have risen to other heights, and yet he may never have risen beyond the peak he attained that night. This I do know, that in raising to those heights he made upon me a lasting impression that will be with all, that will be with me always. Okay? Having landed at Broadway, I arranged on site a defence position for my second column. My role was, my orders were, to move to the south as quick as I could, once I established Broadway, to check up on Piccadilly, and then to go on and block the Irrawaddy for as long as I could. Not far from where I crossed it, the Zimbung Gorge. It was a good sight, and we could have denied the river to the Japanese. They were using it quite a lot for quite a while, until they built up enough strength to move me from the Zimbung Gorge. My role then was freelancing. I had to go off now in the whole of the area north of that, and to amount quite a lot, falling quite a lot of the defence of Broadway were necessary. Having returned to Broadway eventually, 111 Brigade were establishing their block at Blackpool on the railway. And as in fact, in the meantime, we'd had that awful news that Wingate, on the second day after he'd been to see us in Broadway, had been killed. He was missing. Nobody knew what had happened until the remains of his plane was found in high grounds beyond Imphal. I think the most depressing moments of my army career were those. I think that applied to every other Chindit who knew that we'd lost undoubtedly an outstanding leader. To me, he'd been a friend and a commander, and no doubt I think I got more stick from him than any other of his leaders. We knew each other very well, and he never ever gave me the cane or the stick if he thought I was doing my best and my men were with me in that. They'd undoubtedly, the private soldier wasn't hero worship, but Wingate to them was the star of everything. And I'll never ever forget the depression. I can only speak for my own column, but it came on that column on the night we'd heard that Wingate had been killed the previous day. We didn't know if we would all be withdrawn from Burma or left there. But this I do know, that a part, a very valuable part, had left all our lives, all those who knew him and served under him. The battle must go on. I returned to Piccadilly, had a last look at it, then I moved on to Broadway. And from there I was instructed to assist 111 Brigade in establishing a Blackpool on the railway valley. Mike Calvert had been very successful in his block of the railway down the south towards Cathar. But to have two successes was hoping for too much. Blackpool never really dominated the railway valley, and my role as battalion commander was just not on to float round it, because on one side you had the open railway valley, and at the other side, where Blackpool was located, The hills were too steep for men to get up, let alone mules. And eventually, I was taken inside Blackpool for the final sort of battles of the of that era. The story of Blackpool has been written by far more able pens than mine. It wasn't good. It was a poor site. It was a site where allowed no freedom to the commander to defend himself with his flota columns. And eventually, when the Japanese moved in, it was nothing but hand-to-hand fighting. And the then commander of Blackpool, Jack Masters, was ordered to evacuate it. And my column did the rear guard. And so we were the last out of Blackpool. And because I knew the countryside, I and a few of my men were the last up the valley. The true picture of the fighting that went on in Blackpool and the outstanding performance of the British Tommy has not yet been written. British Tommy and Gurkha Tommy has not yet been written. I hope someday it will be written. But this I do know. It was no fault of Jack Masters, who was then the brigade commander, commander, or those who served under him, that we had to finally move out and hand it over to the Japanese. We got a bit of our own back later on. We moved into Indoji Lake and moved north, and then drove the Japanese from the high land overlooking Mogong in the distance. But this was no compensation, really, for those people who'd fought at Blackpool and never were able to fight again.
Can you describe what the fighting at Blackpool was like from your own personal experience?
Yes. As I've said, the idea of having a floater column round Blackpool was not on, because the site was on the side of the jungle, facing over an open valley with deep streams and the railway. Either side of you and to the back was the high ground rising up from the railway valley. It was so steep you couldn't operate with mules, and at times my men had to go up hand over hand. And so it was far from the block that Wingate would have operated, I'm quite certain. And had the powers that be seen the actual thing on the ground, they would have fully agreed. Jack Masters, the brigade major who was left in command of the site, could not have done anything better than he did. He fought and had us all fighting. In the end, it was hand-to-hand fighting in the block itself. And our main aim then was to get the wounded up over the hill into Indoji Lake, where we hoped we could fly some of them out. I happened to be the one who did the rear guard from Blackpool. But the Japanese only followed us up for a matter of 400 or 500 yards. Whether it was that they disliked the steep rise they had to be with us overlooking them, or that that's what they wanted, I shall always believe that what they achieved was to relieve the railway valley open for them and only be able to deal with Mike Calvert and his brigade on the other side of the valley. Having cleared Blackpool It left the way open for them to attack at Mogong. It was there that 77th Brigade put up such a magnificent fight and won in the end, and handed over to the Chinese, who had come down from the north.
In his book, The Road Past Mandalay, John Masters describes the fighting at Blackpool in quite horrific terms of fighting at extreme close quarters under horrific conditions.
Yeah.
Is that your own memory of it?
Oh, yes, I was one of them, doing the fighting in the middle. See, my soldiers, the ideal of having a column was to have one column inside and one column floating. Well, see, it was open country, as flat as that. That was split in two. That was a railway valley, and this was up like that. The monsoons began, and they're trying to step here. You had to go up hand over hand almost. There was a track up it, which Masters eventually went, and I did the rear guard up it. But the Japanese only, I say, followed up a few hundred yards, and it had enough. And they were glad to get us out of the valley, because then that meant there was no opposition. Mike Calvert had lifted his block lower down. He was then fighting for Mogong, and so it left them open to get at him. We were trouble on the wing, put it that way. But, yes, I'll tell you.
Were you wounded in the fighting at Blackpool?
Yes, yes.
How did it happen?
Got a bullet through my head. I was running at something, and I got a bullet through the flat brim I've got of my jungle hat. We had the felt hats, and I was running, and I got a bullet through. That's the only wound I ever had. My hat.
Where
I
did
was
it
wounded.
Hit you?
What? Didn't
did
hit me.
Hit
went through my hat. So it was a near miss. It was quite another 4 or 5 inches over that way would have gone through my head. And yes, it was hand to hand. I'll tell you one instant.
Can you put it on tape?
Yes, yes. Looking back at Blackpool, when one was over the hill and safe in the valley beyond, alongside Indorjee Lake, one looked back at some of the near misses and some of the laughable things that happened. In the closing minutes, or certainly closing half hour, or quarter hour, we found ourselves fighting hand to hand with the Japs inside the block. Colonel Thompson of the King's Own and myself had two small parties of 3 or 4 men each. Right in the middle of the block was a tree.